The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is strongly advised. And welcome to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live this evening, send her an email, instudio101@gmail.com. Right to your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome down to Down the Garden Path, where we discuss down-to-earth tips and advice for your plants, gardens, and landscapes every week. Thank you for joining us once again. As a gardener, and even more so as a landscape designer, I think it's possible and important to have great gardens that are low maintenance, which is why here on Down the Garden Path, we do our best to help you achieve that. And there's always lots of educating that goes on while you're listening into the show, so I'm sure you're going to love tonight's episode. We are talking about invasive plants, and I'm really excited to have someone from the Ontario Invasive Plant Council here to chat with us.
Isn't that like amazing that there's actually a council
for
that?
I know, we're going to talk about that, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And I know that our listeners are from beyond Ontario, but I still think there's going to be lots to learn tonight. So please stay tuned.
No more weed be gone.
That's right.
All right.
So we are the So the Ontario Invasive Plant Council is an incorporated, nonprofit, multi-agency organization founded in 2007 by a group of individuals and organizational representatives who saw the need for a coordinated provincial response to the growing threat of invasive plants. They operate through a small office and staff located in Peterborough, Ontario, under the direction of a board of directors containing representatives from federal, provincial, and municipal governments, as well as academics, industry representatives, and a range of environmentally focused not-for-profit groups. And their mandate is to provide leadership, expertise, and a forum to engage and empower Ontarians to take action on invasive plant issues. Colin Casson is joining us. He's the product specialist with the Ontario Invasive Plant Council. And he spends most of his time coordinating the early detection and rapid response network for Ontario, as well as managing their social media and assisting with other projects and conducting outreach, which is why it's great to have him on the air, right? So he's been on staff since 2015, and after completing his master's degree at the University of Toronto, and he says if you have 8 to 10 hours to spare, ask him about invasive earthworms and their impacts on plant community diversity. I think that might be another show. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Thanks very much, Joanne. It's nice to be here.
So there's lots to talk about, and I am really curious about the earthworm, so we're going to have to talk about that near the end, or we're going to have to schedule another show.
Be careful what you wish for. We might go at it for a while here.
Okay. So I think it is a big topic, and I know our listeners are from all over, so what's invasive to me might not be invasive to someone, you know, in, I don't know, I guess name a place, I'm sorry. Like Northern Ontario is different from what's happening in the GTA, right? Coast to coast. There's a lot of different facets. That's what makes this kind of a challenging topic, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I guess the good news is with many species, you know, we're not alone. Our neighbors to the south and north and east and west, they're all dealing with or many of them are dealing with the same species. Sometimes we have kind of our own unique battles here in Ontario, mm-hmm. but certainly our neighbors have a lot to learn, and we've certainly learned a lot from them too.
Excellent. Can you define an invasive, like, is that a good way to start?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a great way to start. So I guess, you know, depending on the context, I think people have different definitions, but kind of probably the best working definition would focus in on the fact that we're talking about a species, and it could be any kind of species, not just plants. It could be bacteria, it could be pathogens, it could be insects and all kinds of critters.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, we're talking about species that aren't from that area historically. So we're talking about very long periods of time, you know, relative newcomers to an area.
Okay.
So a native species would kind of be the polar opposite of that. A native mm-hmm. species would be something endemic to an area. You know, in Ontario, and probably where most of the listeners are listening in from today, we'd be talking about something like a sugar maple, something that's kind of been here in one form or another for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and kind of has its own suite of locally adapted insects and kind of, you know, it's formed this entire web around it.
Okay.
Whereas an exotic species is a species that's just the opposite, something that's not from here. It's not necessarily good, it's not necessarily bad, it's just a species that for, you know, on a scale of thousands of years is native to another continent or
right.
another part of the world.
Right.
And the invasive, those are the big banner ones. Those are a type of exotic species, so kind of a subcategory of exotic. And those have all those negative kind of nasty impacts. And it depends on who you're speaking to. You know, sometimes people might be more focused on sort of biologically focused or biodiversity or ecological based arguments for why something has negative impacts.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're more economic in nature. So the cost of, you know, cutting down all kinds of native ash trees due to the invasive mm-hmm. emerald ash borer would be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes there are human health impacts. Something else we can talk a little bit later, maybe like giant hogweed.
Mm, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize that you also consider, because the emerald ash borer that you brought up is more of an insect, but that's a great example of something that's, invaded Ontario and invaded, North America, really, right?
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely.
working its way and absolutely decimating the ash species.
It is, and that's one of our more common urban forestry or tree species that we'll find in most parts of kind of the greater Toronto area.
Mm-hmm.
We're usually looking at 10, 12, maybe even 15% of regional forest cover being ash.
Yeah.
And that's the sole host for that invasive insect, the emerald ash borer, that's not native to here. So it's a good example. I think it's a good working example. Many people are familiar with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as the plant council goes, is that something you deal with a bit of it, right?
A little bit. I mean, we're more so plant focused.
Okay,
we like
so you are.
Focus in on horticulture and mm-hmm. kind of managing natural areas from a plant perspective.
Okay.
But it's really hard to parcel these out too much more. So, you know, we'll usually start talking about dog Australian vine, and it's just a good segue into some other invasive taxa as well.
Yes, exactly. It's all about education, which brings me to, which is, I think, what's I'm so excited about the show is that so we can continue to educate. I mean, you mentioned dog strangling vine. Me, as a landscape designer, I've written several articles in my, I do a monthly newsletter to my clients. And they just don't know when I'm out in people's yards. They don't know what it is. I actually have a neighbor who has it twined up trellises on either side of her front door because she doesn't know what it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I've tried my little best to try to, explain to people what it is and what to do about it. But I think your Grow Me Instead program is another thing that I think it helps with awareness, right? That's a marketing, like kind of a marketing education program.
Yeah, it's we're really proud of it. It's kind of one thing that was created out of a bit of a need and a kind of a niche appetite for realizing that, you know, the horticulture industry is a great opportunity for us to help address the number of species that are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, it's challenging for everyone to know everything about these species.
Mm-hmm.
They're always changing. There's always new ones coming in or kind of threatening Ontario. So it's a good opportunity. It was a good kind of segue for us to try and turn off the tap a little bit of new species coming in. So our Grow Me Instead program, people are probably most familiar with the brochures.
Right.
We launched that program in, I guess, 2011.
Okay.
So it's been going for a little while now. And now we're up to kind of two versions of the guide. We've reprinted them and updated them to be a little more current on what kind of species and varieties are coming in. So we've got a Southern Ontario guide, And we have a Northern Ontario guide too, so that kind of addresses more species from more hardy climates.
Okay.
So to date, I was looking up the numbers for the show today. I couldn't believe the number. I had to recalculate it a few times, but we're at 50,000 guides distributed over 7 years. So
we're
pretty excited about that. I think that probably shows there's a good appetite for the content and a lot of interest in it. And I guess more recently, we started to realize that the guides are great, and a lot of people have them, but we thought it'd be kind of neat if we could roll out some Grow Me Instead native seed packs. So we've done that for the last 2 years, and we've distributed over 5,000 of those too. So there's a ton of interest in it, and we love talking about it.
Oh, great. Grow Me Instead seed packets. That's a great idea. Okay. And so there's a variety. I mean, when it comes to invasive plants, I personally see them as two kinds. You know, the kind that the nurseries unfortunately still sell, and people say, oh, I want, you know, it's tough and it'll grow anywhere, and that's what they want. So to me, I call it invasive, thinking of gout weed, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Would you consider, is that something you would consider, or are you thinking more, you know, the dog, like to me, then the next level would be something like dog strangling vine, giant hogweed, garlic mustard.
Yeah, I think it's fair. It's a fair point, I think, to make that, you know, not all invasives are created equal. There's some that are kind of more nuisance species, and then there's some that range on the other end of the spectrum that are, you know, ecologically devastating, like literally changing how ecosystems function and driving ecosystems from really diverse, rich areas down to, you know, richnesses or number of species of 1, 2, 3, 4. So, you know, I think it's kind of treated on a case-by-case basis. I think the goutweed example is a good one. It's a pesky one. It's a bit of a nuisance, you know, but there's certainly some that we have on our radar that are a little bit more problematic and kind of, I guess, deserving of a little bit more attention.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. But, yeah. I mean, I think it's a good way to get, for me, to get the homeowners to just pay attention, you know what I mean, to what it is, like to what an invasive species is, or how that plant, you know, how you can't kill it, right? Because people are like, oh, if I, you know, if I get tired of it, I'll just pull it out. And like, no, that's not how it works, right? Because it, you know, it's much harder than that, like the other species, right? It's so, so in
a
way, I see what you mean. Yeah, I see what you mean, that it's because it's not affecting biodiversity and different, our forests or things like that. It's in people's yards. But I think it's a good conversation starter, because anybody who's had it or you know, or their neighbor has it, right, they get it, kind of thing. So it's a good way to kind of segue, I think, to some of the other things.
And I think, you know, I think garlic mustard's a perfect example. When we're doing kind of those you know, outreach focused workshops, maybe it's, you know, the first our group's first experience with invasive species, I always refer to garlic mustard as the gateway invasive species.
Okay.
You know, it'll kind of lead you down a path and give you lots of opportunities to start the conversation about what is an invasive species. You know, what are some of those shared traits? Well, when we're talking about garlic mustard, it's interesting. I always challenge people to go up, have a look at garlic mustard. Pick a leaf and have a look. Do you see any damage or do you see any nibbling on the leaves? And usually, pretty much always the answer is absolutely not. And that's a good opportunity to jump in the conversation and start picking at people's brain. Why don't you think there's any damage on that leaf? And usually the conversation goes to the place where we start talking about, well, in, you know, the mid or early 1800s, when we brought over that invasive species garlic mustard, we didn't, you know, we intentionally brought it over.
Okay.
But we didn't bring over its whole suite of, if you want to use the term, enemies, or whether it's, you know, seed-feeding beetles or stem-galling wasps or even soil bacteria. We didn't bring anything over. We just brought over the plant. And so all of a sudden, garlic mustard is doing, you know, what any organism is put on the planet to do, essentially, to reproduce. And so that, you know, so it's really interesting. It's a good species to start talking about those shared traits and how, you know, usually invasive plants and invasive species, they're able to escape their enemies. And that's why we see them forming those really dense monocultures or area of nothing but one plant, is because nothing else can kind of contribute that competition factor that it does have in its native range.
Okay. And it's fairly innocuous looking, isn't it? Like, you know, there is often one where people will say to me, is that a plant or is that a weed? You know, it flowers pretty and, you know, well.
It does, yeah. I mean, I think if you're a Trillium, you'd be shouting, it's a weed. you know, because that's kind of one of those species that garlic mustard really quickly outcompetes. If you think of those kind of native spring ephemerals, if you're walking through a nice woodlot in early April and thinking about those first wildflowers to pop out, the trilliums, the bloodroot, maybe Canada mayapple, some of those really nice flowering native plants, you know, those are the things that's the kind of community that garlic mustard loves to invade. And, you know, it does really well in those forested areas. It also does really well in kind of slightly more open, maybe kind of forest edges or along a pathway. But it certainly does have a nice little white flower for, you know, a week or two. But the rest of the time, it's pretty pesky.
Yeah, for sure. And so it does grow in sun or shade.
Yeah, it's pretty wide ranging. That's another, again, if you're, you know, thinking about those shared traits between invasives, it's funny, we talk about invasive fish, we talk about invasive insects, we talk about invasive plants. They tend to share a lot of those same traits, and garlic mustard is certainly one that shares that kind of generalist trait. It does pretty well here, does pretty well there, you know, in heavy shaded environments, along forest paths, in a little bit of a more open area. Even in full sunlight in hedgerows, it tends to do reasonably well also. Wow. So they all tend to be those jack of all trades type species. They're really flexible and adaptable. It's a very, very common shared trait with invasive plants.
So the Grow Me Instead program is a guide that shows, you know, examples of invasive plants and then what people can plant instead, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like, think of it as just offering helpful alternatives that you could swap out a plant. If you happen to have an invasive plant in your garden, and, you know, everybody always likes to point the finger to the last person who owned the house. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a Norway maple or whether it's goutweed or any number of invasive plants, the guide is broken down into a few sections, and they're kind of, we have the first section on grasses, we have a section on wildflowers, a section on trees and shrubs, and a section on aquatic plants.
Okay.
And basically each of those sections, if you kind of imagine just a fold-out, just like a longer brochure, if you haven't seen the guide before, and it would be divided, you know, two pages, each page divided into a half. So we're looking at four kind of parcels. And imagine in your head, one of those parcels would be colored in red background, and that's an invasive plant. And it would show a few pictures of an invasive plant. Let's say it's Norway maple, for instance. And that would tell you some of those reasons why it's not a very good plant, I guess, for lack of a better word, why it's justified to be called an invasive plant. And then the other three boxes on those two pages would be colored in green background, and they would be native species. So they would have different, the idea is that you could swap those out with similar light requirements, similar soil moisture and soil type. And the hope is that you could swap those species out. So if we were looking at that invasive Norway maple in a red parcel, we might look at the green parcels of things like sugar maple or maybe some other native maples that could be swapped into a similar environment.
Okay, that's good. So that really helps people plan, I think. And on the show, I'm always about that great landscape, start with a plan. So this is just another aspect of that, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, the purpose of the guide is not to go and rip out a new garden and start scratch on your entire yard. It's really, like you say, planning and kind of just putting that seed in people's head to start thinking about when it is time to kind of start, hit the reset button on a particular garden or maybe start fresh with a new one. You know, these are some of the species that have kind of more additional benefits. Usually they're really good pollinator plants or pollinator species, really nice wildlife attractants to the garden, and also visually stimulating as well. So we're hoping to check all those boxes that many of the native plants tend to check. But I guess it is an important point to make that the Grow Me Instead guide is not just about native plants. Mm. It's really focused in on non-invasive plants.
Okay. Yes,
so,
that
know,
is a good
the
point.
The guide does not have a problem with you if you're an exotic plant brought in. If you're a tulip that was brought in, you know, tulips are not native to Ontario or North America.
Mm-hmm.
But they have no negative impact.
Right.
They're an exotic species, but they're not an invasive species. So the guide would very much promote something like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good distinction to say. It's just, and I think the biggest part for me, I would say, is just informing people what an invasive is and that any awareness that's what they could have in their yard or their neighbor has in their yard, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of these are not uncommon to find. You know, they share a lot of those same traits, so we can kind of predict where they're going to pop up. So if we had the game where, okay, everybody, you know, go away for 5 minutes and go find me the following three species. You know, if we know a little bit of the life history and that background information on the species, it can make them a little easier to go and find. So, yeah, they tend to be around. And I think, you know, it's it's completely reasonable to just jump into this one species at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Just start, you know, thinking about plants that aren't, you know, if you walk your dog on a certain trail and you're very familiar with that trail, and all of a sudden you see a brand new species that you haven't, you know, you're not familiar with, you haven't seen that for the last 10 years that you've been walking the trail, you know, there's a reasonable chance that that could be a species that's not native to the area and potentially invasive.
Okay, so what should someone, so is that what your counsel's for? Like, is that something then somebody should make a call? Who should they?
Yeah, well, there's lots of great resources online. That's kind of where we see ourselves. I wish we had the ability to kind of go out and check out every plant with folks or guide people through a little bit more. We're certainly happy to try and answer inquiries over email or over the phone, and we do that quite frequently. But a great starting place is our website. It's www.ontarioinvasiveplants.ca. And we've got some great fact sheets up there. There's a couple of good resources that are just kind of a flip book of the most common invasive plants of Ontario, the things that you can probably expect to see 80% of if you're out for an hour walk with the dog.
Okay.
So there's some really good kind of, you know, good, nice picture flip guides that I think are really good resources. They're on our website. But it just, you know, caution everybody that it's a bit of a wormhole if you identify that species.
Yes.
You know, dog stringly vine, oh my gosh, you start to see it everywhere.
Yes,
same with
yes.
Brag bites, so.
Yeah, for sure,
so,
for sure.
Yeah, be aware. But if you do decide that you've identified a species and you think to yourself, well, this is probably something I can tackle on my property, there's also some good resources on the website as well for managing.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And I did want to talk about that, some best practices and things like that. But I thought, why don't we pause for a commercial break and we'll speak more about that when we get back. How's that sound, Colin?
Sounds great, Joanne.
Excellent. So thank you for joining us here on Reality Radio 101 Down the Garden Path. We'll be right back.
Let's talk this over.
Are you wondering why your life isn't moving in the direction that you want it to? Do you ever hear yourself saying, it's like I'm running into walls, or my money flows out as quickly as it comes in? Until about 9 years ago, I used to hear myself say those exact words. I could never figure out what was causing these problems or how to fix them. Well, that's until I started to learn about feng shui and how by applying the principles of it to my home or my office, I could in fact help fix those problems and have my life run smoother. Wow. When you book a feng shui consultation with us at Your Spiritual Connection, we will help you to figure out why things aren't working out in your favor, and we will offer simple solutions to help correct the problems, which will in turn help your life to run smoother.
Contact Trish John of Your Spiritual Connection at 905-391-8801. To book your feng shui consultation today. For more information on any of our upcoming events and workshops, please visit our website at www.yourspiritualconnection.ca. Your Spiritual Connection, helping you to make the connections in your life.
Worlds Collide is Oshawa's premier comic and game store. We stock an eclectic selection of comics and graphic novels for all ages and tastes, all sold at U.S. covered prices. Let our friendly, knowledgeable staff find something new and unusual for you to read. Our game department specializes in Magic the Gathering, with a huge selection of single cards available and regular weekly in-store play. We also stock board games, RPGs, dice, and supplies. Can't find what you're looking for? Just ask and we'll order it in. Worlds Collide, 80 Simcoe Street North in Oshawa. Feeding your imagination since 1982.
The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is strongly advised.
Take time to realize that your warmth is crashing down on in.
Welcome back to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw. right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact us live by email, email us right now in studio 101 at gmail.com.
Spell it out for you. No, it's never gonna be that simple. No, I can't.
And now, right back to your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome back, everyone, to our show tonight. We have Colin Casson, a project specialist with the Ontario Invasive Plant Council, with us. Welcome back, Colin.
Thanks, Joanne.
So we were speaking about some specific invasive plants. So I just thought maybe we could talk about, let's say, the top three. I know I'm sure the list is huge, right? So could we narrow it down to the top three and what in the GTA or in Ontario and the best practice for eliminating them? Because I'm wondering if sometimes people are making the mistake of maybe doing it improperly. Does that make sense?
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of the goal of why the Plant Council formed originally, was really to help. It was at a time in Ontario where, you know, people were understanding that, you know, purple loosestrife and other invasive species were quite problematic. And there were a lot of folks all across the province, you know, using those kind of quote-unquote pilot trials to hope to refine methods and find those best practices. And so, you know, that's kind of the name of our game. It's really just to share that information. So I'll do my best to pare it down to the top three. So
If you have to have some honorable mentions, I'm sure that's fine. But
good. Okay, good. I don't want to offend any of them. So that's
great. Right. Okay, so go for it.
So, you know, I think anybody who's kind of from the GTA, especially if you've ever traveled on the Don Valley Parkway down from the 401 down to Toronto, you know, you've come across what's called dog strangling vine. Mm-hmm. And some of your listeners, especially listeners to the south, know it by a couple different names. Some folks refer to it as swallow wort or a couple others. So dog strangling vine, as we call it here in Ontario, it's a perennial invasive vine. And those folks who are driving on that DVP are very familiar with it. If you look to your left and look to your right, chances are very good that at least one side you'll see some dog strangling vine. So it's in terms of where we can find it here in Ontario, you know, you can see it distributed pretty widely across the 401 corridor.
Yeah.
It's our major connector corridor that kind of links kind of southwestern Ontario all the way over towards Montreal. And you can find it in most spots in between. And it showed up in, I think it was 1899, seems to be the best, most commonly cited year of introduction. So it's been here for a fair amount of time. But it was first brought over kind of near Royal Botanical Gardens, just on the west end of the GTA. And it's very, it kind of held its own for a little while. It didn't escape too far outside of Toronto for decades and decades. And something happened in the 1950s, 1960s, and we really saw its population explode across the province. So we started to see it pop up over near Ottawa and over towards Montreal on the east end of the province. So at this point, you know, it's really become pretty widely established. And I guess if I'm to justify it with just one reason for why it's not a good species to have and why it's something to be aware of and to control early if you find it on your property is, for me, I like to make the biodiversity arguments. I think that's a really good tie-in, and that speaks true to me. So the good biodiversity-related story with dog strangling vine relates to the native monarchs.
Ooh.
So those butterflies, you know, everybody's very familiar with monarchs and pollinators and the benefit of pollinators. And,
yes.
Monarchs are at a bit of a disadvantage because their host species, the one plant that they rely on for basically all of their life stages, are native milkweed plants. And milkweed and dog strangling vine are botanically very closely related, despite the fact that dog strangling vine is indeed a vine. And it's invasive. It's not from Ontario, not from North America. It's native to different parts of Europe and Asia. But they look so similar in nature and leaf structure and kind of chemical composition and smell and all sorts of other traits that the monarch butterflies can't tell them apart. And so monarch butterflies have been documented many, many times in Ontario as going up to dog strangling vine, this invasive vine, and laying their eggs on dog strangling vine. And unfortunately, in Ontario, we don't have any documented cases of eggs that are laid on dog strangling vine actually surviving into adult maturity. So basically the story is that if you're a monarch butterfly, you know, a pollinator, a species of concern, something where we're keeping a very close eye on their populations, and if you go lay your eggs on dog strangling vine, it's not good for your potential offspring.
Right, because it's not the same food. They can't, right, to eat like they would a milkweed.
Yeah, exactly. So even though it's closely related, mm-hmm. it's just not quite good enough food for them actually to survive on. And so that's, you know, I think that's a good reason. But I think from maybe a homeowner perspective or somebody who's active out in the outdoors, there's plenty of other good reasons why dog strangling vine yeah. is something to be aware of and something that's not your friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good competitor. If anyone's out from kind of the east end of the city, there's a good forest called the Orno Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a perfect example. If you're not familiar with the area, imagine yourself being in the middle of a nice red pine plantation. You know, a very thick, mature forest, maybe trees that are 50 years old, 40 years old, 60 years old even, and looking into the understory and seeing nothing but green. And unfortunately, yeah. this green is nothing but dog strangling vine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good competitor. It kind of outcompetes those small seedlings that would come down and grow and form that next wave of forest,
mm-hmm.
that next generation in 15 or 20 years that yeah. forest would mature into. Dog strangling vine can outcompete those and kind of choke them out, basically, for resources. So that's another, yeah. I guess, reason why DSV or dog strangling vine is a concern.
Yeah.
The only good news story on dog strangling vine is that I have never heard a report of it actually strangling a dog.
It's true. Know? It strangles everything else. I didn't want to say that. Yeah, it's definitely not good exactly. for other plants. And I'm in Pickering, so close to the Rouge and Valley, you know, and it's definitely... I know the forest, and we've had arborists on, Gary, remember Jason talking about it, Into the Woods,
I do.
How it's taking, yeah, it's incredible how this little, in your yard, it looks fairly innocuous, but you're right, well, Colin, now, that out in the forest, it's going uncontrolled, and it can, you know, take over these trees.
Now, everything yeah, that Colin is discussing, I'm sorry, Colin, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry about that. Everything that he's discussing, that also... is the same true like south of here, because you have a lot of listeners in the U.S.
That's right.
So I just wanted to, because I know we were stressing, we're talking about southern Ontario mm-hmm. here and in the greater Toronto area, but for our listeners around the world, Colin, what you're explaining, that goes pretty much anywhere, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, Gary. Thanks for bringing that up. So they, you know, most of the listeners out of the States would refer to this as swallowwort, either pale swallowwort or black swallowwort.
Okay.
Is another very closely related species with those same negative impacts. It's also invasive. And yeah, they're faced with the same challenges that we are. Most of our efforts to try and, you know, refine our best practices for how do we control the species? What are our chemical control options? You know, are there any digging or mowing options that are mm-hmm. effective? Or can we use any other number of control techniques? A lot of that is based on kind of the insights from our neighbors to the south and mm-hmm. the lessons that they've learned. And, you know, they share some of our best practices as well. So it's a good reciprocal situation that, you know, we're all in the same kind of crummy situation
yeah.
together
yeah.
and, you know, looking to find at least the most effective control techniques that we can use.
Okay. So with dog strangling vine, what is the most effective? Because I've heard some things, but I just want to see what you say.
Yeah, I think, to kind of address that question for, you know, any species we're going to talk about tonight, we created this series. It's called our Best Management Practices series.
Okay.
And your listeners can check it out on our website. It's on ontarioinvasiveplants.ca/B, as in Bob, M as in Michael, and P as in practices.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of guides there. I think right now we're at 15 or 16 different species, and they're each about 30 pages or so.
Wow.
It's kind of like invasive yeah. plant management for dummies.
Okay.
In 30 pages or less, all you'd need to know about controlling the species. And so they, you know, they recommend different techniques based on your own situation.
Okay.
So for instance, if you live in the middle of a subdivision and you only have a couple little plots of garden that it's problematic to you, and maybe you only have 10 plants that have popped up, well, it would recommend to you that just simple digging it out is the most effective control technique.
Okay.
And it would also tell you that, you know, a lot of people would think, well, if I just break off the vine at the stem, kind of at the soil interface, maybe that's enough. And there's, or maybe if I do that once early in the season, and then maybe if when it regrows, I'll do it again late in the season. And if I do that for a couple of years, maybe that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
But our guide is pretty clear in highlighting kind of the latest research. And there's one really interesting paper I'll tell you about that we cite in the guide related to dog strain length iron. And it's out of a researcher from the States, Lindsay Mailbrath is his name. And what he did was he went to a very large, imagine a field of dog strain length iron, and he divided it up into four areas. And the first area, he went out there and he mowed early in the season, so kind of simulating just if somebody was in their backyard picking the plant at the root.
Okay.
And then the second plot, the other quarter, he went over and he mowed twice, so kind of mow early in the season and then maybe mow in July or August. The third area, he mowed four times, so kind of every month. If you're out mowing the lawn, imagine mowing DSV. And in the fourth area, he did nothing to it. That was his control plot. He wanted to ask the question, what's the most effective technique here? Is it worth the effort? And really interestingly, what he found was that if you go out there kind of with the best intentions and go out and mow only once, so the best of intentions, he actually found that those plants, they kind of get, you know, a little upset here. They go into defense mode. They think, oh, my gosh, I'm under attack. I need to reproduce as much seed as possible.
Oh, more aggressive?
Yeah, way more aggressive. So he found more shoots regrowing, and he found more flowers and seed production as well from that area that he only mowed once compared to the area he did nothing to. So I think that was a really interesting finding. And on the other end of the spectrum, he found the area that he mowed four times, so very heavy, frequent mowing, kind of preventing it from ever getting to the point where it could actually flower and produce seed. He found that although that doesn't, that almost completely stops it from going to seed, so you're kind of, again, turning off that tap, you're stopping the problem from getting worse, it didn't have a massive impact on the actual kill of the root of the plant, the really robust root structures.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if a listener is listening in and they've mainly only got 10 or 12 or even 20 plants in their backyard, and digging it out and getting that root crown, you know, removing as much of that root as possible, if they're able to do that, that's going to give them really effective control.
Because that is hard to do. So for our listeners, it's not easy. It's not an easy plant to pull out, right? And it does require a bit of digging.
Mm-hmm, it does. I think the kind of the standard dandelion tool, that, you know, maybe a garden trowel would be pretty effective. If you've got reasonably loose soil and there's not too much clay in it, I think you can have some good success with just digging it out kind of one taproot at a time. But you're right, they are pretty robust roots. So you need to make sure you get a good chunk of it, at least, ideally all of it. But don't worry about the root fibers. They're not going to regrow.
Now, my question to you is disposing of that now. So now I know I'm guilty of it, of doing getting rid of it, but then putting it in my leaf compost bag.
Yeah, I think we don't have an awesome answer in Ontario at this point. I think there's a lot of people going out there, realizing that this is kind of a niche to study,
right?
Realizing that we need to have a more science-based, rigorous response to this issue. But what I think the best answer, at least at this point in time in Ontario, is that, you know, all municipalities deal with their yard waste in slightly different ways.
Yes.
Some, if you're out kind of near north of Mississauga and Caledon, they have a high heat compost facility. So we can send it to that facility and be sure that it's going to be kind of, you know, even the most resilient seeds and root material, they're going to be killed in that high heat compost.
Okay.
But if we include kind of that, you know, if we just take a bunch of mature ripe seeds and shake them into the leaf yard waste bags and put them at the end of the curb, we know that in most municipalities, those just tend to go to kind of windrow compost or very large kind of loosely turned compost. And we're just not sure that seeds that are going into that, at least at this point, we're not sure if they're getting hot enough in Ontario to kill that viable seed production. So what I think, and I know it's a bit of a complicated answer, but I think the best suggestion I could make to your listeners is if you have what you're looking at these dog strain length vine seeds and they look pretty ripe to you, you know, they kind of look like milkweed seeds because they're closely related. They have that white tuft that floats in kind of a nice autumn day. If they're at that stage, they're really far advanced and they look like they're mature seeds, I would say throw it in the garbage. Send it to the landfill.
Okay.
But if it's earlier in the season and maybe we decided that mowing was the best option for us because, you know, maybe we have too much dog strain length vine or maybe we just, you know, can't dig out all those roots. If we're just going to take a weed eater to it, I see no problem in sending that material to the yard waste.
Okay.
So mixing that in with the leaves and sending it off there because we know it's not going to reproduce. The only two ways it'll reproduce is if we take those root crowns out and plant them somewhere else or if we take those seeds and move them somewhere else also. Okay. So the short answer is, if it looks like it's viable, I would send it to the landfill.
Okay, to the garbage. So that is, that's a good, I think it's safe, right? Safer to know that it's not, you know, we're not just turning it into next year's mulch that's going to be on someone else's garden.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
And I think the same at least applies for kind of the backyard compost, is that, you know, pretty much any invasive plant material, as is good practice with all good gardeners, you know, if you have disease looking or weed seeds or invasive plant material, it's probably best not to put them in the backyard mm-hmm. compost. Just send that to the landfill or at least off site.
Okay. And I've heard that they're also not, and I've experienced it myself, the, you know, current chemicals that we have in Ontario, they don't respond to that either.
It depends on what you're using.
Okay.
So we have, I think, as last time I checked, we have two herbicides in Ontario that are available to use. And one is a glyphosate-based, so
right.
kind of a Roundup or other similar products mm-hmm. to it. And that's probably the most commonly used herbicide or chemical.
Yes.
And that can be very effective. The challenge is that, you know, I think where your listeners are from, they're going to have different regulations and different mm-hmm. access and availability
yep.
to use these herbicides. Some folks in the States, in many states, the regulations are a little bit less stringent than
yes.
they are here in Ontario. But in Ontario, we have a pretty good, pretty solid conservative-based regulations
yeah,
surrounding
yeah.
who can apply herbicides and under what conditions. Are you near water? Do you have a license to apply the herbicide? That kind of a thing. So a lot of, you know, if we're talking about a large scale, maybe a conservation authority is managing, or even a municipality or a nature conservancy property, something like that, if it's a very large-scale infestation of dog strangling vine, chemical control tends to be the best
okay.
the best approach.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some really effective herbicides. It just kind of depends on, you know, are you able to apply herbicides and what your budget is, that sort of a thing.
Right. Okay. Wow, time is flying. So can we quickly talk about the site? So that I hope our listeners will tune in and look at the website to learn more about dog strangling vine. Can we cover one more?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what a lot of people call Canada's quote-unquote worst invasive plant is Phragmites. And I think that's a good species to highlight. And it's
okay.
got some roots being like historically brought over here as an intentional introduction. It's a very tall grass. If anybody's ever driven on a 400 series highway
oh,
and seen
that grass,
foot
yes.
or taller grass
okay.
with that kind of, some people say the seed head looks like a Swiffer duster head.
Okay.
It's got, you know, a very large, robust seed head. And so that's called Phragmites. And that's, as I said, it's Canada's worst invasive plant, according to many folks. And it's pretty ubiquitous across the province. And if you're a cattail wetland, a cattail marsh, or any kind of wetland, that's that kind of habitat that's at risk from this invasive grass,
mm-hmm.
this perennial invasive grass.
Okay.
In terms of, I guess, your audience and thinking about what are the horticultural tie-ins to this species, I think the best one I could make here is I see a lot of gardeners and a lot of folks out at the side of the road collecting this
mm-hmm.
because, you know, it's very nice looking. That's
yes.
why we brought it over.
I get people asking me, can they have that in their garden or should they put that near their pond? I do get that request a lot.
Yeah, I bet. Or even I was thinking even in like kind of nice ornamental,
mm-hmm.
I guess, kind of winter arrangements maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we tend to see that. It does
yes.
have the element of height. But,
yeah.
you know, usually what we see is that, you know, people picking that up and we're seeing seeds kind of fly all over the place
mm-hmm.
as they load it into their car, drive it home, and all of a sudden they're potentially acting as a vector or a pathway
wow.
for spreading it. So certainly not something to recommend.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's another great topic. I think we do need a second show, Colin. I'm going to have to book you with that because there's so much to talk about, and I definitely want to you know highlight more of what your council does. You had mentioned that you also take part in plant case studies.
In case studies, yeah, we're pretty actively involved in, I guess, trying to find the existing answers to some of these questions
mm-hmm.
whenever possible.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, whether it's control techniques or whether it's, like I said before, about somebody raising the alarm that we don't know the best practice for disposal of invasive plant material, those sorts of things. So we're really pleased to be able to kind of work with some of our local research partners and and highlight some of their research that's happening, and also kind of put the bug in their ear. Hey, could you try and answer this question for us? Because
right.
nobody seems to know the answer.
Okay.
So we've worked on that disposal question I talked about before.
Oh, good.
And a couple other research projects for control techniques.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, so do you find, are you going to municipalities? Are they coming to you? Like, is there an awareness there so that you can, because I think a lot of it is if they're taking care of the public spaces, then that makes it easier for homeowners, right?
We get a lot of grassroots interest in the topic, obviously. We do a lot of talks at horticulture societies, mm-hmm. master gardeners, those sorts of groups. And even kind of non-horticulture stakeholders, field naturalists or friends of this park type of group. So there's certainly a lot of grassroots level interest in the topic, but the same can be said for mainly municipal staff interest.
Right.
We've in the last 2 years or 3 years now, we created this guide called, essentially what it's trying to do is be a bit of a how-to for a municipal staff member to create an invasive plant strategy.
Okay.
And a strategy is just a fancy word for saying who are the partners involved in managing invasive species and invasive plants when they show up, and how do we better kind of break down some of these barriers? Because
mm-hmm.
what a lot of municipalities are telling us is that many municipalities are very big corporations.
Mm-hmm.
They have various yeah. lines of business and disciplines or divisions that might not speak to each other on a very regular basis.
Yeah.
But many times, people who shouldn't, many people would suspect they don't have a role to play necessarily in invasive plants. They find themselves dealing with them all the time. And a good example of that is, the obvious example is a parks and recreation type crew out there managing public parks and public infrastructure. But another good example of folks dealing with these are roads crew and operations
mm-hmm.
departments
yeah.
dealing with municipal roads, county roads, provincial roads even. And we're finding it's really hard, invasive species, the one message I think that listeners could take away with is to understand why this is such a daunting challenge from a big scale, from a provincial scale, or even a bigger scale, a national scale, is that these things find their way between jurisdictional boundaries
right.
so well.
Yes.
And many other issues can be slotted into a particular ministry
mm-hmm.
or a particular division.
Yeah.
But invasive plants, they just tend to find their way right in the cracks, whether yeah. it's on the fringe of a provincial
literally and figuratively, right? Literally
exactly.
and figuratively.
Yeah, so that's really the big challenge. And municipalities
yeah.
have been right on board about if they're interested, they're engaged. But the one message I'd leave off on that note with is that it tends to take municipal council will in order to make these things happen. The staff
mm.
understand that there's a need and interest to identify all of the variety of stakeholders within the municipalities to
mm-hmm.
deal with these things, but it's ultimately up to the people out there to show council that this is what we want, this
mm-hmm.
is what we need. We need people working together on these things.
Yeah.
And that these are a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point. So it comes from both sides, for sure. Wow, so that's a lot. To consider. So yeah, so I guess you're also reinventing the wheel. So if you've got a municipality who has managed to figure out, or whether it's even in upstate New York or something like that, like this example with the mowing, right? That's the great thing about sharing that information.
Absolutely. I mean, these plants are acting pretty similar throughout their invasive range, whether it's, New York State, Michigan, or Wisconsin, or Quebec, or Manitoba, or Ontario.
Right.
There, a lot of our resources have been created with partnership of adjacent states and, learning from their, successes and failures and vice versa. We like to talk about when we mess up just as much as we like to talk about when we actually find the right solution. So,
exactly.
So,
well,
great resources. They're on our website if anybody like to check them out. They're there free, ready to be used.
Yeah, excellent. So more information about the best management practices, more great information on the website about the top invasive plants, and also to get the Grow Me Instead guide. So where is that? We do have a listener question who's asking me where to get those guides. Grow Me Instead.
Well, if you need to scratch your itch right now, they're available on our website if
okay.
you want to have a look at the PDF version.
Excellent.
I know some people just like that physical hard copy. So
mm-hmm.
if you want to find our contact information on the website or even just shoot me an email, it's Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at oninvasives.ca. So that's Colin at oninvasives.ca. And we're happy to ship them out for free. Another good resource on our website is we have what we call the Grow Me Instead Nursery Recognition Program.
Okay.
And so that's a list of all sorts of nurseries across the province and plant distributors who are kind of, you know, they'll have this material on site. They're acknowledging that invasive plants are not something that are good for us to be selling as a province, and that non-invasive alternatives are good. So they have those guides in store that are free. So, you know, pick them up, pick up a couple native plants, and you can pick up a guide too. So that's on our website as well.
Excellent.
But we're also happy to ship them out, or any of our resources that we have in print, we're happy to ship them out for free. We're just a broker of information.
Oh, good. And I know I belong to the Horticultural Society, and I know we've got them as well. So I think somebody must have ordered some from you. And so that's good, because that's another way to spread the news as much as possible. So that's good. We have just a little bit of time, but I did want to mention the Invasive Species Act, Canada's first province with a piece of standalone invasive species legislation. So that's something that your council helped make happen?
We were certainly there cheering on the provincial government when they were listening to all their stakeholders that, look, we need some legislation to give us some teeth, because, you know, many people are pointing out, I'm sure, and aware of that, these invasive species were legally bought and sold in Ontario for a very long time, and we just needed something to turn off the tap on new species coming in.
Okay.
You know, if your listeners are interested, check out, just Google the species water soldier, and you'll find a perfect example of the type of species this act was designed to help prevent the sale of in Ontario.
Okay.
And so it came into effect in late 2015, and since has the regulations associated with it that enable us to go to plant distributors. And, you know, usually they're selling these plants and they're just not aware of that the plants are invasive and have those negative impacts. Usually they're quite willing to kind of go along and understand the issue once we help explain it to them a bit.
Oh, good.
But this tool gives us the legislative teeth, I guess, to help kind of address that issue.
Excellent. Okay, that's good. Yeah, I think of, you know, people are seeing, I think, more commonly aware of the insects, you know, like the emerald ash borer, or I think of zebra mussels, right? And something else that's, you know, so there's whether it's a plant or an animal it's incredible how much it spreads and how important awareness is to stopping that. Anything upcoming, upcoming engagements or community presentations or anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, as everybody knows, this is the busy season to be outside. So, you know, our season tends to be the polar opposite. When people are inside interested in thinking about the garden, that's when we're busiest. So we fill up our schedule in early spring late fall, I guess, as well, with lots of speaking engagements. Many horticulture societies and master gardener groups across the province we've been very pleased to speak with. I think we're at over 15 or 16 last year. And many more in years previous. So if that's the kind of thing that anybody would be interested in having somebody come out and chat a little bit more about some of the invasive species in their area, we're happy to do it. So we've got a bunch of those coming up in the fall, but they're still available.
Okay.
So lots there. And I guess beyond that, we have our annual general meeting coming up in Ottawa as well.
Okay.
So that's nice. That's early fall this year. So information on that's on our website as well.
Excellent. And your social media links, you're active. I researched those all today. So you're active on Facebook, on Twitter, as well as Instagram.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're always talking about the different invasive plants, the lesser known ones and the usual suspects. So we're on Facebook at Ontario Invasive Plant Council, and we're on Twitter at using the OIPC1 hashtag, OIPC1.
Excellent. Well, this, I feel bad because it was a drop in the bucket, Colin. It's a great topic. And I hope we can arrange for you to come back and do part two, because I would like to explore more, you know, give more visuals and more awareness to this, especially the specific ones that are affecting people in their yards. I think that's important.
Happy to do it. There's lots of material out there. So,
excellent. There's lots to talk about. And we also have to have the earthworm show, too.
Next season.
Next season. That's a good time. Okay. So, yeah,
absolutely.
We'll chat. We'll chat tomorrow and find out when the best time is to talk about these things. But I do want to thank you so much for joining us. It was a great topic and I learned a lot. And we all just need to keep educating, and so we can educate others on these invasives. Right.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Yep. Well, you have
Sounds
a good
night. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Well, thank you again for joining me down the garden path, and we'll speak soon. Bye for now.
Bye now.
Well, there you have it. I hope everyone learned a bit of
pretty weird about what he talks about.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. And it is anybody walking through the forest right now. There are definitely plants that are taking over. And it's shocking that they've been here since the 1800s, but yet now they're really having a big impact. So
yeah, you know what bothers a lot of people is that if you're not really a commercial entity, you're not allowed to use certain pesticides mm-hmm. to get rid of these things in a residential
herbicides,
area.
Herbicides.
But yet, why would a golf course or anything, why are they allowed? Because you'd be putting down so much more because you're talking many, many acres compared to a front yard.
Well, I think the people that actually do it in those situations are actually trained, and it's in a much controlled environment, much more in controlled environment. I think the problem was homeowners just go willy-nilly, and they're not reading instructions, and they're not following all the safety guidelines.
What about, though, if you had a lawn company that's licensed and trained? Why are they still not allowed, right? Because
well,
I can see that.
Yeah, and I think then it goes back to it's also not the exposure. It's the human issue like that. So the homeowners and the children and because now they're exposed to that, even though it might be applied properly by a proper person, the residual of what's on that lawn, it still is a, you know, carcinogenic, and it still is a harmful product for our health. And the studies, you know, that's what led up to the herbicide ban, is that there's lots of studies that prove it's not good for us. So yeah, we have to put up with a few more dandelions, but really in the long run, like,
it's
is it
better.
That big of an idea, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a huge topic. I'm really going to talk to Colin tomorrow and see if we can get him back on.
That's very cool.
Learn more about it, because I think best practices, you know, it really got me thinking about that, about pulling the dog strangling vine and then putting it in the paper bags, you know?
Absolutely.
So
sure.
Are we just really helping spread it? So, So I want to thank everybody. I hope everybody's enjoying the heat. We can't be complaining about the heat, but it's certainly...
Is it too cold in there?
No, it's fine in here.
Okay.
So everybody's enjoying their garden finally in the last week or so that we've had some nice weather. And look forward to speaking to you next week and talking more about what's going on in our June gardens. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to Reality Radio 101.
Thank you for listening to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101.